Good morning, I'm Cindy Felixson, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Thank you for the introduction. I gave them a lot more to say about me, but next time. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me, Cindy, for inviting me to come share with you. You may have heard, you may have had the good fortune of hearing my little brother share yesterday morning, as Marty sees it. But this morning we are here for the truth. He's a new guy. He just turned 25 years sober. And I'm 25 years and 11 months. So just enough to really rub it in so it hurts. I know it's also surprising that he's my younger brother, because he looks so much older than I do. It's always great to get the podium last. Before I forget, too, after the meeting, I won't be able to shake hands with you because I thought I was speaking yesterday, and I got to immediately leave and go get on an airplane. But I want to thank you for having me here. And last night when they were bringing that cake in, I kept thinking about how great I would look on that stretcher. If they kind of just brought me up the center aisle when it was time for me to speak, you know. I like to make a grand entrance. On TV a few years ago, I saw this Michael Jackson concert. This is back when everybody liked him. And before he even appeared on stage, people were screaming and just convulsing, kind of like Michelle was up here, you know. And after a few minutes, some smoke came up on the stage. And then people were just losing it. They started crying. And after a little bit of time passed, all of a sudden, he just kind of popped up like this. And people were passing out. And then he stood that way for a minute, and then all he did was go to this side. And they were tearing people off, and they were sobbing. And that's the kind of response I want. Every time I walk in the room. It's funny, I went to the Al-Anon luncheon yesterday and heard Vinoy give a great talk, as he always does. I almost hate going to those luncheons, though. I mean, when you hear what we did to these poor people, you know? I mean, I just sit there and it's just like my heart just rips, you know? Because when I was drinking, I thought I never hurt anybody. I used to tell my dad that all the time. I'm not hurting anybody. I'm just drinking. And anyway, just listening to those Al-Anon stories, it's just gut-wrenching, you know. And the weird thing is they love us, you know. They're obsessed with us. And Vinoy was saying that she was addicted to excitement, which is how my sponsor describes me. I've not always been the delicate flower that you see before you. And I'm on sponsor number 11. Clancy. But I've had him for 22 years. Anyway, saved my life. As you know from Marty's story, I'm an Eskimo from San Bernardino. Don't tell anybody, though. And there aren't a lot of us. In fact, there's 3 in my tribe. We're all in AA. My mother went back to Alaska where she lives now, and my dad raised 3 of us kids by himself. We were all under the age of 5 when she left. And I don't know if you've ever been to San Bernardino. Don't go if you haven't been. It's really ugly and smoggy and horrible, and I hated it there. And I knew somehow I was just like an Eskimo princess that was on some, you know, wandering iceberg and ended up there. And I just hated it, you know. And the weird thing was, my dad kind of looks like Lou, our speaker last night. He's German and Irish, and I thought I looked just like him until I went to school, you know. And when I went to school, all the kids would make fun of me. You know, they'd call me a Jap and a Chink and all these terrible names. And I just grew to hate the way that I looked. Like, I remember I would come home from school and I'd sit on the edge of my bed and I'd kind of like stretch my eyes out so they'd become round, and it worked. But I started smoking dope and they just shrunk right back up. By the end of the party, everybody looked like me. Now, I am, as Dr. Silkworth describes in the doctor's opinion, restless, irritable, and discontented, unless I can get that ease and comfort which comes at once with taking a few drinks. And if you're anything like me, Southern comfort does the trick. I love whiskey. I love malt liquor. I love them together. I love them on my Captain Crunch with Crunch Berries. And I threw up a lot. Now, oddly enough, throwing up, I have heard of some people say that they threw up and they quit drinking because it embarrassed them or it didn't make them feel good, you know. And to me, it was just part of the evening. You just throw up, you feel better, and you can drink more. So that, apparently, is abnormal drinking. I love what Chuck C., my sponsor, used to say. He said, I couldn't integrate myself into society. And that's the way I felt. I just could not make myself fit. And for some reason, when I drink the right amount of whiskey, I don't care anymore. And I never did a lot of drugs. I smoked a lot of pot. I didn't really do drugs. Someone gave me amphetamines for a couple of weeks for free and then said, you know, I can't keep giving these to you. You've got to pay for them. So I just gave them up. You know, when you get that feeling of wanting to mow the lawn at 2 o'clock in the morning with flashlight and scissors. I've already got an edge, you know. Which is why I love whiskey, because when I drink the right amount of whiskey, I love you. Oh, and I want to tell you how much I love you for hours while I'm weeping. I'm what Hank J. used to call an emotional goober. I was in a gang for a while. I'm sure you've heard of us, the 7 Leafers. I had a little problem. I got kicked out of this gang. Now, gangs weren't in the 70s like they are now. But in this gang, you know, we used to beat people up from time to time. And my problem was when I was drunk, they'd be beating them up, and then I'd go cradle them afterwards and rock them and tell them how much I loved them. And I kind of put a damper on the gang image. So they booted me from the gang. And I love that one on the 20 questions, did you seek lower companions? And that was one of the ones I answered no to, because I looked up this Speedy Spike and Spider, you know? My dad was a periodic. He drank a lot of Gallo red wine and Brew 102. Come from a real high-class family. And he just drank for a while, and then he'd not drink for a while. And if you heard Marty's story, he was a probation officer, and he handled drunk driving cases. And he decided one afternoon he'd go to an AA meeting because he was sending all of his clients there. And he's been sober for 28 years. So then my hell really began. Because he was now sober. There were no homeless back in the 70s because my dad took them all in. We had his sponsor one day brought over a gunny sack full of dead plucked ducks and threw them on the porch. And my dad went and filled the bathtub up with cold water and threw the ducks in there. And I have to tell you about my other brother, Meeks, who's not here this weekend. He had a strange way of working with drunks. When you saw things that he didn't, he would punch you in the face so you could see clearly. Now, there's a couple problems with this that I see. One, it was usually me seeing things, and he punches hard. And the other problem was, he was loaded too, so he was seeing things. So if I didn't see what he saw, anyway, I was in the bathroom and probably throwing up, and something kind of caught the corner of my eye, and it kind of looked like they were ducks, but they were real relaxed. So I finished what I was doing and walked out in the living room, and the only one home was my older brother, who didn't say anything, and I didn't say anything. And, you know, the next night we had duck for dinner. I just felt better, you know, but I couldn't tell what was real and what wasn't anymore, you know, and our book talks about that we can't differentiate the true from the false, you know, and that's the way my life became because I couldn't tell that I was hurting my father. And I couldn't tell that I was hurting my family. And my last drunk was in January of 1977. Marty hates this story because it makes him look so bad. But he's bad. So two girls came over and they brought a fifth of Southern Comfort, and I hadn't seen them in a while. My friends kind of quit hanging around me. I was the kind of kid you weren't allowed to hang out with, and I was like always being put on restriction for life. And you know, I would do stupid things like sneak your kid out of their bedroom window, and we'd go to a party, and you know, I'd manage to get your kid back home most of the time, but I would, you know, I had like a forgetting kind of problem, you know, like I'd get your kid up on the porch, ring the doorbell, and I'd forget to run. So, little things like that. So anyway, these two girls came over, and that I hadn't seen in a while, brought us a Southern Comfort, and we were sitting around and not using this exact language, but we were talking about how things were going to be different. I never meant to get as carried away as I did. I did mean to get drunk, but I didn't mean to get as carried away as I did. And things were kind of different. We actually drank out of glasses. And I don't know if you remember those Ronald McDonald glasses they used to make back in the 70s. We used those and even threw a couple of ice cubes in. I drank mine. I drank what was left in the bottle. The way I look at things is, you're not done with yours by the time I'm done with mine. I'm rightfully entitled to yours. And I take it. So I knew I couldn't hold it and sit down at the same time, so I carefully placed it on this arm of this couch and this chair that were next to each other. And as I sat down, I knocked it over. And I just started sobbing. That was the last of the booze. Now, I was not based anywhere near reality. It didn't dawn on me I could get more or steal more or somebody would bring more. That was just the end of the booze. And coincidentally, it was the last of the booze for me. But I was just sobbing, and I went into a blackout that lasted 3 days, and I came out of it a couple of times. But as I went into the blackout, something overcame me, and it was love for Marty. And I have to tell you, and Marty shared it, you know, there was a lot of hatred in our home, and we had, I don't know, 4 to 10 fist fights a week in our home, and bloody lips and black eyes and all that stuff. But, you know, I told you, if I drink the right amount of whiskey, you know, I'm overcome with love. So this particular night, I loved Marty. And I had to go tell him how much I loved him. We lived 2 blocks away from Riverside City College, and I knew he was over there with a security guard, getting loaded, driving around looking for illegal activity. And so I made my journey to go find him and tell him how much he meant to me. And while I was out there, they were there. And this time, they had a cannon, and they were firing it at my face over and over and over again. This is kind of an odd description, but maybe you've been this drunk. I could feel particles inside my face, but I couldn't feel pain. And I kept wiping my face, and there were little chips of rock and glass coming out and little streams of blood. And the second I would get it wiped off, they'd fire another load at me. I found out later what had happened was I was just climbing up a real steep hill, and with my dead drunken weight, I just kept landing face down into the ground over and over and over. They finally got me up to the top of the hill, and we were in the alley behind my house. And there was my little brother and his best friend lying against the garbage can. And their shirts were ripped and they had chains wrapped around their neck. And my little brother's best friend's brother was standing there, and he said the gang came by and took care of them. Is that for me? Yeah, if any of you people are getting up and walking out in the middle of my talk, just pretend like you're a doctor and you're taking a call or something. So Jerry said the gang came by and took care of him. So I just started sobbing. And they hopped up and said, ha ha, we're kidding. And they were, see, isn't he awful? They were eating the ketchup, you know, and, you know, you can't take grief away from an alcoholic. And I was into this. So I still thought he was dead. They were talking to me. They were shaking me. I'm still convinced that he's dead. So they take me into the house where my older brother is, who then starts to punch me in the face so I can see clearly. And I just did what I often did, is I took off all my clothes and started throwing up. And they just threw me in my bedroom and closed the door. Now, what I forgot to tell you was that evening, my father didn't have to go to work. His job, his first job in sobriety, was at Kellogg Mental Institution, graveyard shift, running the adolescent unit. And it was great. We had a party at our house every night. And he'd work with crazy kids all night long, and he'd come home and find crazy kids passed out all over the place. And he was a newcomer in AA and just, you know, poor guy. Anyway, he sat me down and he said, I'm going to an AA meeting tonight and I'd like to invite you because I'm taking David. And David is 2 months older than I am. And I had met David in Alateen. I went to two meetings and they kicked me out and they asked me to never come back because I was drunk both times. But I remembered David. He had blonde hair about as long as mine is and played the drums, smoked Marlboros, everything I wanted in a man. And my dad said, I'm taking David to an AA meeting. And I said, why are you doing that? And he said, David's an alcoholic. I said, oh, God, I'm sorry. And he said, why don't you join us? We're going to go hear a man named Chuck C talk. And Chuck hasn't had a drink in 30 years. And I remember thinking, why? Would you want to go sit and listen to someone who hasn't had a drink in 30 years? You know, it didn't sound like a great evening. And I said, no, that's all right. You know, I'll have a drink for me and a drink for David, because I was kind of in mourning for him. And off they went to this AA meeting, and, you know, my dad came home, didn't have to work that night, felt real spiritual. He just heard Chuck C talk, just took a newcomer to an AA meeting, and came home, and all these kids were all over the house, and he had asked where I was, and they said, she went to bed, she's got a headache. And so he wanted to come give me a kiss goodnight. I guess he'd been reading The Family Afterward or something. And they threw this teenage barricade up in front of my door and tried to block his entrance. And they said, she's really got a bad headache. And anyway, he made his way through, and I had long hair then like I do now, and I had eaten that night. I hadn't eaten in a while. Spaghetti. Oh, I know you did it. Won't go into graphics. But my father walked into my bedroom and I was lying in this bed of pasta and my eyeballs are rolling in the back of my head and I was completely white for the first time in my life. I missed it. I heard it didn't look that good, so my dad carried me out into the living room and asked these kids, you know, what's wrong with her? And they said, she's got a headache. Now, he thought I had taken a bunch of pills. And I told you I didn't really use a lot of drugs. I don't use pills because they can kill you. They're dangerous. So it wasn't pills. And he threw me in the car and took me over to Riverside Community Hospital. And took me into the emergency room and started to pump my stomach. And I did it for myself, all over my father and the doctor. And I sat up and I said, oh, F, I'm drunk again. And I just passed back out. And the doctor looked at my father and said, Mr. Stekdob, I'm sorry, but we're going to put a 72-hour hold on your daughter. She's obviously trying to kill herself, and she's not far away from doing that. And then we're going to send her over to Kellogg Mental Institution. They've got a great adolescent unit there. He said, I know, I run it. And brought me home. I came to the next morning to what I thought was a really loud storm. You know, it was just my dad slowly backing out of the driveway, going down to the local Alano Club where he always went when bad things happened. And bad things were always happening. And right before this, I don't recall the timing exactly, my dad went to Chuck C's house to go talk to him about these three practicing teenage alcoholic kids that were driving him crazy. And Chuck said, well, you've got to release them. So my dad interpreted that to, he should send us to Alaska to go live with our mother. So anyway, my dad somehow, I literally fell to the floor, crawled out to the living room where all these kids were. They told me what had happened. Somehow they got me into the kitchen and they got me on the phone to the Alano Club, and some guy picked up the phone and said, oh, we've been waiting for your call. And then my dad got on the phone and he came home and he talked to me. I have no idea what he said. The gist of it was that I had to go to AA. And at the end of the conversation, he said, you got to take a shower. And I said, I can't. And I remember he took my clothes off of me and he put me in the bottom of the shower and just turned the water on. And I was told the first 2 days that I was sober that I slept in the bathroom with my head wrapped around the base of the toilet bowl or up on the toilet seat. And the next time I came to, he was picking my face up off the toilet seat and started pouring, I don't know what it was, milk or buttermilk down me. And I just threw it right back up and I looked up at him and he just had tears just coming down his face. And he didn't say anything and I couldn't. And I remember he just put my face back down on the toilet. And the next time I came to, I don't know, maybe it was the next day, I don't remember. But I was on the telephone again, and this time I was talking to David, the young man he had taken to the meeting a few nights earlier. And David had now memorized the 12 steps, and it was really nauseating. And he said, you know, in AA, the great thing is, this is, you know, a disease that you self-diagnose. No one can tell you that you're an alcoholic. But in your case, I'm telling you, you're an alcoholic. And he says, I'm going to pick you up with my mother and we're going to take you to an AA meeting. And I said, I'm too sick, David. And I think I literally was too physically ill that night. And David and his mother, Lori, which I hear they're here in Sacramento somewhere now. I hope they're still around. And a man named Don L. came and they picked me up and they took me to my first meeting. And I sat in the back of the meeting in the Triangle Club, and I was still throwing up, shaking and awful. And I remember the last time I came to was when my father was shoving me in the back of that car. And he said, they may call on you tonight. I said, what do you tell them? He said, you tell them your name and your disease and that you haven't had a drink in 3 days. I said, wow, 3 days? I mean, I couldn't believe I had 3 days sober. I can't get 3 days sober. I mean, it was almost all in a blackout, but anyway, I went to that meeting. I don't remember anything anybody said. After the meeting, all I remember was a lady named Martha came up and she talked to me. And Martha was everything that I hated, really, but I wasn't hating her at the moment. But she was blonde, you know, fair skin, blue eyes, and she was beautiful. And she had a nice, soft voice. And I don't even remember what she said, really. And I remember that she was clean. You know, she had probably showered like that very day even, you know. And I just remember she was gentle. And I hadn't encountered anything gentle in a long time. And I just sat in that meeting. I changed my sobriety date since that meeting because of marijuana. Oddly enough, you guys don't even smoke dope, you know. I thought, how else can you stay sober if you can't smoke pot? But they made me change my sobriety date. That's the date I have now, March 10th of 1977. And I had 9 sponsors in my first 2 years of sobriety. I had one emotion that would float in and drift out, and it was the feeling that I've got to go now. That was it. And when it arose, I would pack up my box and I'd move. And I didn't stay in any town for more than a few months. And like you've heard a few of the other speakers over the weekend talk about, I got worse when I got sober. You know, I know one of these pop psychology terms that everybody uses today are issues. And I had an issue. It was called sobriety. Sobriety drove me to drink. I mean, I can't take sobriety, you know. It's too intense. You know, I am stark raving sober when I'm sober. And I'm the kind of person where whiskey just takes the edge off, you know. So now that was taken away, and I was left with everything that drove me to drink in the first place. And our book says alcohol is but a symptom. And So I just was getting progressively worse. I went to a lot of meetings. Marty was talking about it, but we were so active at meetings in the fellowship, and just, you know, we'd caravan and we'd go hear all these speakers talk, and went to a lot of meetings, and I started moving a lot, and I finally figured out what was killing me was L.A., the fast pace, you know, rushing to every red light, and the line was always in front of me, and so I got the feeling that I got to go, so I packed up my box and I moved to Oregon, and I got up there, and it was blue, and it was serene, and it was quiet, and I was looking around, and I thought, God, I hate nature. And my head just got louder and louder, you know. You know, your heart is ripping, your gut churns. You listen to sad songs on the way to the meeting. You glance at him from across the room. Show him what he can't have. You never look better than when you're broken up. And the only problem is the pain goes away. It always, 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 always goes away. So I'd get another sign from God that would say, get back together. So we did this about 18 times. Give our group something to talk about. And he went out and got loaded. And it was devastating. But fortunately for me, I was on sponsor number 10, and she made me make a commitment to her and to a home group and to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had those things a little bit stronger than my obsession for that man. And it held me in good stead, and I just kept putting one foot in front of the other. He was out using for about a year, and then he started coming back to the AA meetings. And we started glancing at each other from across the room, and I got pregnant. Clancy sponsored both of us by now. So we were engaged for 13 days and got married before the Wednesday night meeting. So now I'm pregnant. I had always hated children. I'd hear them crying in restaurants and I'd think, God, why don't they just smack that thing? So I was real nervous as to what kind of mother I would become. And so was everybody who knew me. I remember one Friday night sitting in a meeting, and I was about 4.5 months pregnant, and I felt this ripple go down my stomach, and I screamed. I don't know if you've seen the movie Alien, but an odd thing happened. I started falling in love with this baby. Oh my God, and it was so important to me just to remain alive, because I couldn't wait to meet him, you know? Now, when Daniel was born, he was screaming his head off. And the first thought that crossed my mind was, let me hold him so I can make him feel better. And I'd never felt that way about anything in my entire life. And I just started a great love affair. I mean, I just love my kids so much. And I guess when Daniel is Dan now, he's also 6'4", he's 16. When Dan was about a year old, John got loaded again. And then it just started, you know, tumultuous emotions in our home, and it was just awful. He'd get 30 days, and then 60 days, and then 4 months, and anyway, after a couple of years, I left that marriage. And that was, to that point, the hardest point in my sobriety. And it's so interesting that the best day and the worst day of your life are one and the same. The day that I was dying in my bathroom with my head wrapped around the toilet bowl was the worst day of my life. But it started my life with you people. The day that that marriage ended was the worst day, and it was the best day, because I got to the place that it talks about in the book where we exhaust self-will and human resources. And when we do that, we can begin to affect a conscious contact with God as we understand Him. And that was the beauty that came out of that. I moved to Iowa, where Julie lives now, and went back to school. And on the summers, we'd come home and to L.A., and Dan was supposed to stay with his dad, and I would stay with my girlfriend, Rita, and usually John was loaded by the time we got here, and Dan would just end up staying with his grandparents. And the last time we did that, in 97, we came home, and by the time we got home, he was loaded again, and John spent most of the summer in jail. And at the end of the summer, before we went back to Iowa, John wanted to meet with Dan, and Dan was so angry with him because he's ruined every summer for him. And that's what our disease does. You know, we take the people around us down. And I told Dan, let's just meet with him. I don't know when we'll see him again. And so we met him for a milkshake, and I just sat across the table from him, and I looked at him, and I met him when I was 17 and started going with him when I was 18. And the person that I knew was gone already. I mean, there was just a shell of what once was. You know, there was no life left in him. And we left the next morning, and I didn't know that he overdosed that morning and choked on his vomit. And I found out a couple days later, because I was traveling across the country, they couldn't get a hold of me. And my sponsor, Clancy, called me on the cell phone that I rented and told me that they had found John dead. And so we came back to L.A., and Clancy did part of the eulogy. And there were just tons of AA people there, you know, just loving us. And Dan and I got back on a plane, and we went back to Iowa for our last school year. And I remember Dan and I were sitting in the parking lot, and he had just seen the Star Wars trilogy, because it was kind of before his time, but he really liked this trilogy a lot. And we were sitting in the parking lot, and I don't know if you know that little guy called R2-D2. He kind of looked like a trash can, and he was on rollers, and he just bleeped and all that stuff a lot. And C-3PO was the guy in the brass, human-like staffer, who spoke 6,000 languages. So Dan said, you know, he says, my dad is kind of like R2-D2 with no C-3PO in the world. He said he has nobody to interpret for him. And that's what I'm like. You know, I'm R2-D2. I don't know how to connect in the world. I can't connect to you people. And my sponsor and these AA meetings and these steps are like my C-3PO. Somehow it turns things around so I can connect to you. Because I came here, I was severed from humanity. Our book talks about the loneliness and despair, and that was my life. So I came back to L.A. and just have lived all over the place. And, you know, my life is good most of the time now. And I didn't tell you this, but when Clancy started sponsoring me, I would call him, because I was such a nut, about 4 to 12 times a day. Not for a bad week, not for a bad few months I was going through. I did it for about 3 years, solid. And Benoit was talking about it in the Al-Anon meeting is something beautiful that happens when one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic. And this man was so crazy that his insanity made him uniquely useful to me. Because I can stand up here and tell you now that I'm happy most of the time, and I am. But I can also tell you in one sentence something that doesn't begin to capture what I'm trying to convey, and that was, I was insane. And I was insane sober. But I'm not insane anymore. You know, and that was the sentence, I was crazy. And there's a world of stuff behind that. You guys have given me the tools on how to live. I got mentioned a few times over the course of the weekend, but I got engaged last weekend. I'm not even pregnant. But I'm just crazy about him. I mean, we have so much fun. And funny enough, too, I work for my father now. And he trusts me. And he consults with me. And he asks my opinion on things. And, you know, I don't know how you get from there to here. You know, a kind, loving God gave me a mean sponsor. And here we are. I remember calling Clancy once, and I was trying to sign up for college classes, and I couldn't even shop in a supermarket until I was several years sober, because I just can't stand crowds, you know, and I don't like the lines, and I'm very impatient. I'm one of those people, I just like the idea of people. And at my best, they're a low-grade irritation, you know. I remember Colin Clancy, I was trying to sign up for these college courses, and there were just like all these lines of people, and I didn't have a car at this point. I got everywhere on roller skates, and I remember calling him and just in a frenzy, and he said, you know, they're all in line too. Wow. Sponsors can be very deep. and I remember telling him, I said, God, I'm just, you know, so filled with despair, and I said, even visually things look darker, and just going on and on about how terrible everything was and how dark it was. And he said, well, why don't you just pull your head out of your ass? And I thought, I am going to skate down to that mission and tell him what I think about him. But all that came out of my mouth was, okay, I'll take it out. I don't know anybody more actively involved in AA than my sponsor, and action has been the magic key for me. I'm just the kind of person, my emotions are so intense, and I just take the footwork, you know, just take the footsteps. My sponsor promised me, you know, the feelings will change, and they have changed. I rely absolutely on what our big book tells us. There's a line in the book that says it works. It really does. And there are some interesting tools in there. You know, it says when doubt or agitation arises that we pause and ask for the right thought or action. To catch it at doubt or agitation takes some real fine-tuning skills. I'm aware of it at suicide or homicide. Then there's a clue that something is wrong. So to catch it way back here, you know, it takes some practice. Because I just have one of those minds, you know, after my divorce, I was single for a while, and, you know, I didn't get to be on the horrible dating scene, and guys were asking me out, and I just look at them and I think, I don't want to divorce you. And raise our children on my own without child support. Next time I see him in a meeting, I hate him for sticking me with the kids, you know? But, you know, what came out of my mouth was, no thanks, I'm tired. I was exhausted. I'd married, divorced, raised the kids. Anyhow, AA works, you know. The AA campus, John was doing a commitment at the Wednesday night meeting, my home group, where we have about this many people every Wednesday. And we have a little thing that we're doing. We go put some money aside, $5 a week. So when Montreal International Convention rolls around, we go as a group. And in Minneapolis, there were about 250 of us that went together. And so Sean was sitting at the table, and I didn't have any money on me that night, so I asked him if I could borrow $5, and he could give me his address, and I would return it to him. Well, now I'm going to be moving into that address soon, so... I guess if anything, the message I would want to convey is Eric Butterworth, not an AA guy, but he had some line that I'm paraphrasing. He said, the past does not exist except held by the thoughts in my own mind. And the steps free me from the past. You know, I hear all these people that come to AA and they're damaged and they're hurt. Get over it. We all were. You know, and the havoc that we wreak in people's lives is just amazing. I heard Chuck C used to tell his wife when he was drinking, you know, she'd say, if you loved me so much, you wouldn't drink. And he would respond, it's because I love you that I do. Now, I understand that because I can hardly stand to glimpse what I've done to you. And when I do, I've got to drink over it. So it's because I love you that I drink. But we all get here with a past, you know, and it isn't real anymore. Like Lou was saying, it isn't our inward reality any longer. And we get to share our past, our books, as it becomes our greatest asset. There isn't anything that I've gone through that someone else hasn't already gone through before me with dignity and shown me how to walk through it. And I get, because I was such a nut, I get to work with a bunch of lovely, nutty women that can talk to me. And, you know, I'm the kind of person, sometimes I get so crazy, I mean, I just can't wait for the phone to ring so they can pull me out of myself. Coupled with the kind of personality that I hate it when the phone rings. Because I don't want to be bothered, you know? So do action, take the actions, and I show up here, and I've been fortunate to be an active member of AA for 25 years and to be with you people, you know, to have you interpret for me so I can connect to the rest of the human race and become a useful human being. If you're new, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. A friend of mine, Pauline Lupe, back where I live, you know, someone gave Lupe a little tip, and it says, my new life began on, and it was a sobriety date, and that's what happened for me. My new life began. My life began on March 10th of 1977, and I have you to thank for that.